Hey, I'm Scott. Welcome to the show. It's my show, the Scott Show, where I say stuff and also interview people about things. That's a little vague. Well, I'm a libertarian, abolitionist type. And so I'm against everything. My guests, usually not so much. Occasionally, you know, I talk to Sheldon Richmond. He's about as libertarian as hell. Most of my guests, I guess, are probably most. I think probably most are liberals. They tend to be more interested in foreign policy as journalists and that kind of thing. And then, but plenty of conservatives too. And, yeah, and also libertarians. And the subject matter is always the empire. We don't have to agree about everything, but, I'm trying to basically bring you the best in opposition to the empire. I guess I could have bad guys on and fight with them and that kind of thing more, but. Man, no. The whole thing smacks of effort. And there's so many people writing such great stuff that most people don't get to hear about at all that, you know, I think really my priority certainly should be trying to bring you the best of that. That's why I always interview Gareth Porter, for example. So I want you to read everything he writes so that you know the stuff that he wrote so that then you'll be right about things better. Yeah. I wonder how many times per show do you guys out there think, man, this guy is terrible at talking. He can talk at length, but he doesn't make sense a lot of time. I'm trying. Need to go back to college, take a vocabulary class. That's what I need to do. Take a writing class. Learn how to talk better. Whatever. Anyway, today I'm going to interview Mitchell Plitnick. I like Mitchell Plitnick. He writes stuff for Jim Loeb's blog. The Low Blog. That's what I was going to say at first. There's why I stuttered and started with an L sound. Low Blog. Jim Loeb's blog. And a few other places. And check out this cool thing that he did. Debunking the opposition to the Iran framework. It's by him and Matt Duss. Isn't that cool? So what he did was he looked at AIPAC's talking points. You know about AIPAC? AI. I don't know why the I is silent, because it'd be hard to pronounce that way. So it's pronounced AIPAC, A-I-P-A-C, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It's the single most powerful part of the Israel lobby in America, though it ain't all of it. And anyway, they put out some talking points about why to oppose the Iran framework type of a deal here thing that they're working on. And Plitnick and Duss, they went through and explained why the war party ain't right. Imagine that. Are you surprised? When I read this, I was not surprised at how easy it was for Duss and Plitnick to do the job that they had assigned to themselves here. Oh, you claim this? Well, this much is true, that much ain't. Simple as that. Not much of a problem. But it's not like you get to see this kind of thing on CNN or hear it on your local radio station most of the time. So we're going to have Plitnick on to talk about that. And then, man, you know, I had a couple of invites out that I've not heard back yet. Ooh, I better check my email. No, that one's spam. Oh, here's one. What's he say? Yeah, can't make it on before 1:45. Oh, no. Tomorrow afternoon. Okay, well, there you go. Hey, he's a longtime listener, he says. Very cool. I didn't know that. So there's this guy. His name is Michael Gould Wartofsky. And he wrote this thing for Tom Dispatch all about the technology of the police state. What's a five-step program for enslaving the hell out of you here? Let me see. What's he called here? The War's Come Home, a five-step guide to the police repression of protests from Ferguson to Baltimore and beyond. It's running at Tom Dispatch now. It'll be running at antiwar.com tomorrow. And I'll be talking about it with him on the show tomorrow, apparently. And then the other invite I had out, and I kind of left a, I don't know, my voicemail I left for this guy's going to piss him off or what. I kind of stumbled around. But it's this guy, Abdi something something, who is a professor at the University of something in Minnesota. And anyway, Sam Husseini and the Institute for Public Accuracy, they sent out a thing here this morning. Here it is. Abdi Ismail Samatar. Abdi Ismail Samatar is a professor at the University of Minnesota. Okay, so here's the thing about him is that the short kind of blurb that they have here about, you know, a third of an article, basically, is right on. And here he is explaining the Nairobi massacre and the genealogy of the tragedy. And so I know that's right already from the third of the article that I read, not the whole thing, but just the one Sam Husseini sent out. And it's been way too long since I had any good coverage of Somalia on this show. But anyway, it's kind of short notice, so I don't know if that'll work out or not. But we still have time to find out. Maybe he will be able to do it. And then, you know, that Somalia story, man, it's so important. And it usually goes without saying, even on this show, just because it doesn't seem to have too much blowback for others nearby or any major American interests, right? So you have an occasional horrible massacre in Kenya at a mall or a school, but so that's good for headlines for a day, but nobody really seems to get too amped up about it. And that's probably for the best, because, you know, the more you know, TV decides that we all care, the more likely it is that we're going to go make matters even worse for those people over there in the name of saving them. But as you could guess, even if you don't know the first thing about it, the virtually everything wrong in Somalia is America's fault. All of it. It's just horrible. George Bush and Barack Obama and their governments, our national security state, just been beating the living crap out of those people for, a dozen years straight now. Oh, wait. Make that about 14 years. Just beating the living crap out of the Somalis. And for what? For nothing, actually. Just for the slightest bit of independence. The slightest bit. It's a goddamn tragedy, man, if you don't know about it. Oh, here's the worst part of it. There was a massive famine. Hell, there's a massive drought in the Horn of Africa. And in Ethiopia and in Kenya, they had a hard time too. But in Somalia, about 500,000 people starved to death. 600,000 even, more than 500,000 people starved to death. Of course, most of those little children, you know, the elderly, the weak, the under five, more than half of them, according to the U.S. and the U.K. human rights group FuseNet, more than half of them were children under five. They starved. And the reason why is because not just was there a horrible drought, but America's war had completely and totally destroyed their economy. And so whatever food there was no means to distribute it. The prices were all screwed up. The markets were all screwed up. The roads were all screwed up. There were men with guns running around and explosions going off everywhere. And so people just laid down and died. And, you know, it's fun to say it's all George W. Bush's fault, and it absolutely is. But then again, when Barack Obama came into power, what did he do other than crank up the drone war? The famine happened on his watch, and it was his fault, and he didn't do a damn thing about it. And 600,000 people starved to death. So if it's 100% George Bush's fault, it's 100% Barack Obama's fault, too. The bastard. And yeah, I know it's his entire government, but he's the chief executive. That's how it works. So that's the problem with being the chief executive, is if your warriors are starving a bunch of people to death, then, you know, it doesn't really matter if the CIA threatened to kill you if you didn't let them continue or whatever. It's still your fault. And by the way, wouldn't you sacrifice yourself and let the CIA kill you if it meant trying to stop them from starving 600,000 people to death? I wouldn't mind dying for that, wouldn't you? I don't know. So, yeah, it's all Barack Obama's fault. He's the one sitting in the chair. So, yeah, hopefully I'll get that guy on the show for you today. I'll explain. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, guys, welcome back. So, yeah, sorry. See what we can do about getting this guy on the show. Shouldn't have left that voicemail. I sound like an idiot. Damn voicemail. But there's it's a great article here, The Nairobi Massacre and the Genealogy of the Tragedy. Why did this happen? Because America. Stop being ignorant. If you want to read my article that's a couple years old on this, but it's by me, and it's really great, just type in my name and FFF. In fact, you don't even need to put in my name. Just type in FFF for Future Freedom Foundation, FFF Somalia into your favorite search engine. It'll come right up, FFF Somalia. And the article is called U.S. Government to Blame for Somalia's Misery, because I like to try to get right to the point, you know. And, yeah, it's far away, but it's still important. Isn't that funny how that works? You can have something far away and important. And not just as an excuse to bomb it, but maybe as a reason to not bomb it. All right. Coming up in just a few. Again, Mitchell Plitnick will be on the show to talk about Iran. And, in fact, to talk about Palestine, too. And then I probably got more Palestine stories than I'll have time to cover with him. So then maybe in the next hour, we'll cover a little bit more Palestine. This is my Palestine. I got two different sections of Palestine tabs here, man. I'm overdosing on Palestine tabs. I think now I need to. I got two different ISIS sections, too. Yeah, I think now I want to cover ISIS. All right. So, first of all, there's Patrick Coburn. And he's saying in this article at the UNS Review the same thing that he said on the show last week. Which, I guess, 1 week ago, right? Something like that. The Americans said, oh, yeah, the Islamic State, they've lost 25% of their territory. Just look. And then they held up a map where all of eastern Syria, Western Islamic State, is cut off of the damn map. Oh, come on, guys. Well, look, they lost to Crete. Yeah, but so? I mean, they're sort of kind of still a guerrilla army trying to make themselves a state, in a sense. So, where the Americans and the Iranian government and their militia allies came with force, they ran. They only left a few hundred guys to defend to Crete. And they took off. And then they went and they won major victories in Syria and took Idlib. Although they say actually it was the Americans, the American sock puppets in alliance with Al-Qaeda. You're supposed to imagine a dividing line there, I guess, for some reason. Who took Idlib? But, of course, every victory that they make is just winning land for the Islamic State, really. And there's kind of a faction fight there, but ultimately, all the land that they take out of the hands of the Assad regime's hands and their military's hands, they're basically turning over to the Islamic State in effect. And in a matter of time. And then, this is funny. I like this article here. Jason Ditz, Al-Qaeda's moderate allies which, did you realize there was anything left of the Free Syrian Army at this point? The so-called moderates, meaning they'll talk to us and take guns from us, are pretty moderate. Sometimes they cut people's heads off for being blasphemers and stuff. But other than that, they're very moderate, you know. Al-Qaeda's moderate allies worry what happens after North Syria victory. With troops fleeing, the allies could quickly be expendable. In other words, this is, again, news.antiwar.com. Whatever so-called moderates there are the junior partners to the jihadists. And, once the jihadi insurgency is done using up these moderates to get their dirty work done, how long before they turn on them? It's like a reverse of the awakening movement, right? Where in 2007, 2006 and 7 in Iraq, the tribal leaders and the local Iraqi Sunni nationalists and Ba'athist types, they had allied with the Al-Qaeda types and allowed them to be their allies, really to help fight the Americans and their Iranian allies and the Shiite militias. But then once they lost Baghdad, they had too many enemies, as Coburn put it, and so they decided to ally with the Americans, if not the Shiites, against Al-Qaeda. But in this case, the so-called moderates are the ones who are the minority, the small minority of the so-called rebellion here, and it's the jihadists like Nusra and ISIS who are the super majority of it. And so, guess who's awakening to stab who in the back this time? And so, they're worried about it, man. Al-Qaeda could end up being a bigger problem to them than the Syrian military was. Yeah, that's right. And, you know, it's funny because this thing has been going on for so long. It kind of has seemed like, well, I guess Assad ain't going anywhere, right? And yet, then again, I don't know. If the Turks and the Saudis are really stepping up support, if these guys who are now rightly afraid, but the FSA guys with American money and support working with the al-Nusra Front, if they're able to take Idlib, if they're able to bring al-Nusra and even the Islamic State into the Yarmouk refugee camp, which is on the outskirts of Damascus, then maybe the end of the Ba'athist regime actually is at hand, or, you know, within a matter of a year or less or two or so or something. Maybe instead of stalemate, there is steady progress being made against the Assad regime. And then what? Is anybody even asking, then what? If the Assad regime falls and the army falls, that'll just be the end of the first act. That's when the jihad really gets going against the Kurds and the Sunni. I mean, the Kurds, the Shia, the Alawites, the different kinds of Christians, the Palestinians in the Yarmouk camp. That's when they all are sacrificed to the greater good of the Islamic State. And, you know, think about it. This is the big mistake from the Iraq War, they say, right? It wasn't the invasion. No, perish the thought. It was just that, Paul Bremer and, of course, his superiors in the Pentagon, when they de-Ba'athified the army, de-Ba'athified the entire government and abolished the army of Iraq, they had abolished the entire state to create an entire new one in its place and made up of an entirely different set of people. And so it was just set up for civil war, for a massive years-long civil war. And so here they're not just trying to get a lucky sniper shot somehow and get rid of Assad and replace him with the next guy in line and negotiate a compromise and at least you're not Assad or something like this or that. They're still pushing for outright regime change and de-Ba'athification. At which point, all the Christians and the Shiites and, hell, the Sunnis who haven't gone along with the Islamic State, who are many, it'll be militia versus militia at that point, and much worse bloodshed.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
Hey, y'all, run out and get a copy of Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14 by Chris Braswell. The book takes a gonzo look at daily life in America, columns, informational letters, and other marketplace vigilance, a look at drug abuse culture and its marketing, and a series of contemplative and metaphysical essays. Get Embedded Alive, First-Person Journalism in the United States of America, 2013 through 14, in paperback, hardcover, and digital formats at FusePowder.com. Okay, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. On the line, I got Mitchell Plitnick, program director at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. And he's got one here co-written with Matt Duss. Very important piece called Debunking the Opposition to the Iran Framework. Welcome back to the show, Mitchell. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us on the show today. And so now, obviously, there's all kinds of hype on the right and all over the place trying to undermine this deal. So you must have had to narrow it down somewhat when it came to picking through piece by piece and debunking a set of accusations or misinterpretations that needed to be corrected, I guess maybe would be a better way to put it here. So how did you choose? Where'd you get the wrong information to correct here, Mitchell?
Well, it was actually pretty simple because APAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, did it for us.
Oh, that's good.
They put out a little one-page flyer detailing all of what they saw as the problems with the Iran deal. So we were able to look at take those, and you know, they matched up with pretty common arguments. Mm-hmm. So it was a great little foil for us to use to launch our response.
I hope you guys were able to get copies of this thing to pass out on Capitol Hill, like APAC surely had copies of theirs passed out.
We got some up there.
That's good. That's good. Okay, so I guess first of all, could you sort of give us the overview of, you know, in the simplest terms, of what the framework entails? So, you know, what it seeks to do here.
Well, I mean, in a really general sense, it seeks to limit Iran's ability to refine uranium in sufficient amounts to ever produce any kind of nuclear weapon. It eliminates their work with plutonium, and it also allows for an unprecedented inspection regime, so that that their compliance with the agreement can be verified at all times, and you know, that there's a lot of efforts being put into making sure that they're not clandestinely violating the agreement. It's a pretty strong agreement. It really is. Is it perfect? No. Does it permanently stop Iran from ever possibly getting a nuclear weapon? No. But there really isn't any way to do that. So this agreement really is the best deal that is possible to get without completely, you know, destroying the country and bringing on another war.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, I have to admit that the Iranians bent over further backwards than I imagined that they would. The most surprising thing in there was, I guess, the idea that the sanctions would be lifted as quickly as it seemed like they would be lifted in there, as far as our side goes. But on their side, yeah, I don't know. Seemed like they found it where they weren't willing to go all the way to the demand. They certainly went a lot of the way, like changing Fordo, the secondary enrichment facility, to simply a research facility and that kind of thing, right?
Right. I when the framework was first announced and all of the conditions of it were made public, I was pretty surprised too at how far Iran was willing to go. I think it is a credit, frankly, to the Obama administration, the people working on it, because, you know, they got what is a really good deal. They got a deal that I think if you want to attack it, you basically have to distort what it is. And I think that's about as good as they could have done. So, and you know, I think that given some of the things Iran has done in the past, it's reasonable to, you know, to want to make sure that they're closing off as many avenues as possible for violating the agreement on the sly. And I think that's fair. And I think Iran has a lot of Iranians anyway. I mean, there's certainly a fight over it in Iran, but I think a lot of Iranians have just come to the conclusion that, you know, hey, if we can stop these sanctions and we can do it in a way that isn't, you know, humiliating to the country, and we can come to a reasonable agreement and get our economy going again, let's just do that. I think outside of the real hardliners in Iran, I think most of Iran has come to recognize that this fight really isn't worth it for them.
Yeah. Well, and you know, the background of this that they never really talk about, certainly that AIPAC wouldn't bring up, is that the Iranians quite obviously have never intended to be more than a threshold state with kind of half a nuclear deterrent here, an electricity program that could be a weapons program. If you ever start bombing us, we might turn it into a nuclear weapons program as sort of the deterrent level that they have now. And there's really no reason to believe that, you know, I mean, hell, the leak to Haaretz had Netanyahu saying, oh no, the danger here is that, of course, they'll abide by the deal 1000% forever, but that'll lull you to sleep. And then 15 years from now, then they'll make a nuke. I mean, come on.
Well, I think Netanyahu's real concern is kind of that, but it's a little bit different. I think what he's concerned with, and I think what he's been concerned with from the beginning. And again, I can understand an Israeli leader being concerned with this, although not to the point of hysteria as Netanyahu has gone. But what he's really concerned with is that they'll abide by the deal. They will have a growing economy, and their influence in the region will therefore grow. And I think that is very likely to happen. And you know, there's obviously issues there. There's ongoing conflicts between forces that are backed by Iran and forces that are backed by Saudi Arabia, which essentially means also by us, at least to some extent. So I can certainly understand, given some of the things that have come from Iranian leaders' mouths, that Israelis in general are concerned about expanding Iran's influence. Certainly the citizens of Israel are very afraid of Iran getting a nuclear weapon. They've been made to fear that by their leaders, particularly Netanyahu. But even without that, I can understand why they'd be concerned about basically allowing Iran its freedom. But this is the world we live in. And, you know, denying a country the same rights as any other country, especially in the case of Iran, which, yes, has violated some Security Council resolutions, and that is concerning, and has done some gone back on some of some agreements, although so has the West. But although that's true, they've also never launched an aggressive war. And, yes, they do back groups like Hezbollah and have given some funding to Hamas, although that relationship is shaky these days. All that being true, they still have never invaded another country. The only wars they've ever fought are defensive wars, so they don't seem to be a real global threat in that sense. But again, I can understand Israelis not wanting to see Iran's influence grow, but the only option, the only other path leads directly to another major Middle East war, and we saw how well that worked out for everyone concerned, 12 years ago.
Well, and you know, regarding all that, it always seemed interesting to me how after the revolution, of course, you had the hostages taken and all of this, so immediate Cold War with the Americans, but the Israelis kept their ties with the Iranian military and spy services and all that under, and that was under the meaner, old, scarier-looking Ayatollah back then. And as Gareth Porter wrote in his book, Manufactured Crisis, and as I just read this thing in Haaretz by this Israeli historian too, saying, the only reason that Rabin started demonizing Iran was to distract from the fact that he wanted to make peace with the Palestinians. And then every prime minister after him demonized Iran to distract from the fact that they'd never make peace with the Palestinians. But that really, in other words, I'm obviously oversimplifying based on a couple of points here, but it seems like the Israelis could get along with the Iranians if they wanted to. Again, why not? Send somebody over there to talk with somebody, and what's the problem?
I mean, I think that's probably true to some extent. I mean, there are other factors, and I think I would really recommend the book. I'm trying to remember. I believe the name is Dangerous Liaisons. It's by Trita Parsi, mm-hmm. Who heads the National Iranian American Council.
Is that the Treacherous Alliance? Is that the one?
Treacherous Alliance. That's it.
Yeah, that's
Thank
the
you.
One that I've never read, but I sure want to.
It is a worthwhile book. It talks a lot about the dealings between Israel and Iran over the years since the revolution, and it's important reading for exactly the reason you bring up. I mean, I do think that Israel and Iran could find common ground. It's hard to do that, I think.
All right, sorry. Hold it right there, Mitch. We'll be right back and pick right up on that point right after this break, you guys. It's Mitchell Plitnick. At fmep.org. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. Are you a libertarian and or peacenik? Live in North America? If you want, you could hire me to come and give a speech to your group. I'm good on the terror, war, and intervention, civil liberty stuff, blaming Woodrow Wilson for everything bad in the world, Iran, central banking, political realignment, and, well, you know, everything. I can teach markets to liberals and peace to the right. Just watch me. Check out scotthorton.org/speeches for some examples and email me scott@scotthorton.org for more information. See you there. Hey, I'll Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at wholefoodcomplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at wholefoodcomplete.com. All right, you guys. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I am talking with Mitchell Plitnick. He's got this great piece at fmep.org. That's the Foundation for Middle East Peace. fmep.org. It's called Debunking the Opposition to the Iran Framework. And I'm sorry, Mitchell, because I do want to actually get through some of the particulars here. But you're so interesting on so many different subjects. Where we left off, we were talking about how if the Americans and the Israelis can sell a bunch of missiles to the mean old Ayatollah in the 1980s, they can certainly get along now. And so why is it so necessary that everybody's at such odds here?
Well, I think there's a few factors that are, you know, are there in 2015. I mean, there's obviously some history, you know, and it's not all from one side. You know, the recent years with Ahmadinejad in power or in the role of the presidency in Iran, and some of the things he said and did, some of which were mistranslated, but some of which, even the mistranslations made it sound worse, but they weren't nice to begin with.
Right.
Certainly things that I, as a Jew, found very offensive, and a conference on Holocaust denial, that sort of thing is not really endearing to me. And, you know, so there is that. The Revolutionary Guards, who are extremely powerful in Iran, reflect that same sort of thinking. So you have that, you know, sort of deep in Iran as well. And both sides have demonized the other. I mean, with the Death to America and the Great Satan and this sort of thing from Iran and all the things that we've heard out of Netanyahu and from George W. Bush and others, you know, the Axis of Evil and this sort of, I mean, there's been a lot of that, and populations listen. So we have that problem. But I think what's unique about right now is that on the one hand, you have the biggest anti-Iran fanatic, I would say, in Netanyahu, in power in Israel. I mean, I heard Netanyahu screaming about Iran back in the 80s. He's the one guy who's never really let up on that point. And I think it's actually almost an obsession with him. And then on the other side, you had the election of Rouhani in Iran, and that brought Iran into the other direction. So you have the most extreme on one side in Israel, and Rouhani pulling Iran to a more moderate place on the other. And in the end, it was Netanyahu who has largely been made to look bad. His credibility around the world has taken a serious hit. So, let's face it, most of the world supports coming to this deal and recognizes that Iran's come a long way. You know, there's plenty of problems with Iran. The Iranian regime is not the nicest bunch of people, but the fact is they have come a long way on this issue, and there's a potential to engage them on many others. And there's, you know, also a potential for the West to recognize how much of a hand we've had in causing these situations. You know, there's still plenty of bad blood in Iran based on the fact that the United States and Israel were such close allies with the Shah. So there's a lot of work there to do, but it can be worked out because there is a history, and a positive history, between Iran and Israel. And it wasn't only because the Shah was in power. There was, you know, there was real communication between, you know, Israelis and Iranians and Americans and Iranians. And from what I can tell, a lot of Iran wants to have that back.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, to that, I mean, the whole world can see basically Netanyahu's propaganda is about Iran's nuclear program specifically is fit only for American TV. I mean, nobody else in the world looks at it from such a ridiculous conspiratorial point that like, oh, yeah, but have you turned over every single boulder in Persia to make sure there's not a secret entrance to a secret parallel nuclear weapons program there or whatever? Nobody else is thinking of it in those terms because that's stupid. But that's the way they try to portray it to the American people in order to prevent a deal. So you can see why the rest of the world, they just roll their eyes and continue negotiating in real terms, you know, based on the real world that we live in. So,
and the fact is, so do most Americans.
Right.
You know, the from the beginning, the framework and the proposed deal and all of Obama's negotiations with Iran have been supported by a clear majority of the American people, including, you know, a minority, it's true, but a significant minority of Republicans. Who's, you know, who, and, you know, you can't find a single one on Capitol Hill, but they're not representing their party in being so absolutely dead set against any kind of deal. There are many Republicans who support this, and, you know, the Democratic support is overwhelming.
Right. Okay, now, well, geez, I wonder, is there, well, oh, yeah, no, it'll be the top of the hour. Let's go ahead and switch to Palestine. I'll just tell everybody to go read this article and get the point by point in here.
Yes, please.
Because there's no point in just really going through one by one. But the article is at fmep.org, debunking the opposition to the Iran framework. It's by Mitchell Plitnick and Matt Duss. And they just go through and they take all the talking points from the AIPAC flyer on why not to allow Obama to sign this deal with Iran. And they just explain the real truth of the deal here about all the different possible military dimensions and centrifuge facilities and all the rest. So go and check that out. But now I want to switch in the time we have remaining here, Mitchell, to this article that you wrote for Loeb Log, Jim Loeb's blog at Loeb, just like your earlobe, everybody, loeblog.com. It's called Elliot Abrams' Shell Game on Settlements. So first of all, just for fun, remind us who Elliot Abrams is.
Well, Elliot Abrams is a leading neoconservative, veteran of the Reagan and George W. Bush administrations, in which capacity he was convicted of lying to Congress during the Iran-Contra scandal 30 years ago. It was eventually pardoned, of course. And he's an architect of those sorts of policies in the Reagan administration and again in the George W. Bush administration. He had a strong hand in the invasion of Iraq. And in terms of Israel-Palestine, he is a very strong supporter of Netanyahu. And in 2003, he was one of the leading advocates of the letter that George W. Bush gave to then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon that basically said Israel's keeping these major settlement blocks. Israel does not have to even talk about Palestinian refugees and the right of return, and essentially said that, you know, took all of that off the table and said to the Palestinians, negotiate from here. And, you know, it was a big reason why negotiations just became even more impossible than they were before. So that's Abrams, and he's very much the sort of guy who says he support, you know, technically will say he supports a two-state solution, but in every detail he actually opposes it.
Mm. Well, and he's also as incompetent as any of the rest of these hardliners, too, right? Like, can you talk about the results of the election where Hamas got elected in 2006 and then how Abrams tried to engineer a Fatah coup against them and how that worked
out? Yes. Abrams, among others, the way that Hamas ended up being in control of Gaza with Fatah in control of the West Bank is, you know, the election happened despite the fact that Abbas and most of Israel was telling the Bush administration this isn't a good idea, the Fatah is not ready to campaign properly, and and we're really afraid Hamas is going to win. In fact, Hamas did win the Palestinian legislative elections in 2006. And in 2007, the effort between the United States, Israel, Fatah, and some of their agents on the ground in Gaza was to engineer a coup which would essentially expel Hamas. And what ended up happening was Hamas won and ended up expelling the PA and became the sole rulers of the Gaza Strip. Elliot Abrams, among many of the other neoconservatives, were strong proponents of this and helped to facilitate it, in fact, and facilitated a lot of the communication that was necessary between the United States and Israel in a clandestine fashion, because, of course, if you read about it in the news, you had no idea that the United States or Israel was involved in this at all.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, but if you ask these neocons, they're all a bunch of geniuses. So is there any chance that they really did that on purpose in order to split the Fatah and Hamas so severely by geography and the rule over the Palestinian territories in that way?
You know, it certainly is possible, but I think that sounds a little too clever for them, to me.
me too. I was just checking.
I mean,
if you read David Rose's take on the whole thing,
coming, I think Sharon may well have seen that coming. When he was still prime minister at the time, at least at the time of the election. So he may have seen something like that coming, but he's a little smarter than most of the guys we're talking about here.
Right. Well, okay. So now tell us about Abrams' piece in Foreign Affairs here.
Well, Abrams basically seemed to the naked eye to be saying that the settlements are indeed a problem and an obstacle to peace. He has maintained, of course, for many years that they're not. You know, settlements are irrelevant. If there's a deal, Israel just take them down, whatever. And of course, it's never that simple on the ground, and he's well aware of that. But now he's saying, well, the problem is that the settlements that are being built outside of the separation barrier, because the separation barrier basically is stretches out around the big settlement blocks in the West Bank. And his point was that that's what Netanyahu has to stop. And if he just allows the settlement blocks to keep growing and takes care of these ones that are outside of them, that the two-state solution is still possible. And the only way you can maintain that point is be talking to people who've never actually been to the West Bank. Because you can see very easily what's happened. And this I do think Abrams saw coming 12 years ago when he pushed Bush into the letter that I mentioned earlier. He understood that natural growth in the settlement blocks meant that they would expand well into the West Bank and really carve up any potential Palestinian state. And that's exactly what they've done. The different settlement blocks stretched very close now to major Palestinian cities. And the way they do it is because the built-up area of the settlements is only a small part of the settlement blocks. The surrounding area is much larger than the built-up areas. So if you build out, as these settlements have done, well, you're saying this is our land anyway, so we're going to just build out. The problem is then that perimeter also widens. Yeah. And it just becomes this never-ending cycle. So eventually they would just spread throughout the West Bank by that way, by that line of thinking.
And isn't that what happened with this? Isn't it called the – what's it called? I want to call it the E3, but that's something else. There's some
E1, the E1 corridor.
Yeah, yeah. Explain that, could you?
The E1 corridor connects Jerusalem to the settlement of Ma'ale Adumim. And actually, Ma'ale Adumim was set up very consciously in the late 70s as a sort of marker of how far Greater Jerusalem was eventually going to spread. And the E1 corridor is what connects those two. And that's always been the issue, that if Israel builds in the E1 corridor, then we can't eliminate that. And the United States has always pushed them not to build there for that reason. And Israel keeps coming up with plans, and then the United States objects, and they put it off. And they have a plan in there now. They haven't yet started building, I don't think. But that's another place. That's how Israel these settlements are not where they are by accident. And the idea of expanding them – 15 years ago, had a deal been struck, it would have been very difficult, but at least possible, to have some sort of contiguous Palestinian state with Israel keeping the settlement blocks. Today, now with all the growth, it is no longer possible. So if there's going to be a Palestinian state, that part, which is the basis of the two-state solution, and has been, you know, since the idea first gained political traction, that part has to be completely rethought. That's a big deal. You know, that all of a sudden the two-state solution isn't so obviously the solution anymore.
Yeah, that's what they mean by facts on the ground. What are you going to do about it?
Just like and a bully on the playground. And that's what Elliot Abrams is trying to make sure doesn't happen, that reconsideration. He's basically arguing for the status quo by saying just take care of the settlements outside of these blocks. Those are the ones that are the problem. And it's exactly the opposite. The ones that are the problem are the blocks and the amount that they've grown. He knows this. So he's making it look like he's really moving to a more moderate position when, in fact, he's reinforcing the position he's taken, which was to prevent a Palestinian state.
Right. Okay, thanks so much for your time. I kept you over time, but I sure appreciate it, Mitchell.
Okay, thanks, Scott.
All right, so that's Mitchell Plitnick. He is program director at the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Find him at loblog.com and at fmep.org. We'll be right back.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more war in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, you guys, welcome back. Turn that down a little bit. Yeah, that guy Mitchell Plitnick's great, isn't he? You should have heard what he said after the break. And no, I'm just kidding. It was good, but there's nothing shocking or surprising. But yeah, I like that guy, man. He's really sound on this stuff. We were talking about how they expanded that E1 settlement in order to separate Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank, and how the Americans tried to stop them for a long time, and then they ended up doing it anyway. Boy, I'm better. Oh, yeah. All right. So I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Oh, Abdi guy emailed me back. I didn't see. Unfortunately, booked. Thursday. Okay, well, all right. So Somalia's show, that'll be happening on Thursday. That's cool, though. So both of the guys that I emailed this morning who can't do it today can do it later in the week. They both wrote interesting things. So there you go. And no, Codrus, is that how you say it? I disagree, dude. I thought that was lame. I appreciated the premise. See, here's my thing about the Onion skits. I'm a bumper sticker guy. And that's because I used to always drive for a living. And so I'd always be thinking of bumper stickers. And then so I made a bumper sticker company. And then Rick bought it from me. And he made it go. And that was a decade ago. And it's still a company. Imagine that. But so all the time I will come up with a bumper sticker. And I will make the damn thing. And I might even spend 15 minutes on it. And then I just go, you know what? It's not good enough. It was a good idea. That the point I'm getting across, I like it, but you know what? It just, no. And by the way, if you go to libertystickers.com, any of the ones that you don't like, those are the ones that somebody else made. You can tell the difference. Mine are the ones with the poor quality art, but the really hateful slogans, you know? And then there are other ones with really good art that are lame, if you ask me. No offense, Rick. He didn't make up all the lame ones, just most of them. But anyway. So there are lots of times where I think about a premise for a sticker, And then sometimes I even go through with making the thing, and then I throw it in the trash. I don't know. Same thing with the tweets. Man, sometimes I write a tweet, and I want to make a point, and I especially want to shame this bastard who I'm trying to shame with the thing, and then I just, it ain't quite good enough, and so it doesn't get tweeted. Just delete. Delete, delete, delete. Just like when I write an article, then I go back and try to cut everything out. Pare it down, man. Only the good stuff. And I think the guys at The Onion, they have an idea, and then they just get married to it. Yeah, so wetlands, hide bodies. Okay, I could see there's a joke there, right? And we'll have the angry vigilante lady, you know, confused about wetlands or something. But then you produce it, it goes on for a minute, and it's just not good enough. It's not good enough. Not to me. Or I don't know, man. Maybe something. For some reason, the Onion just doesn't make me laugh anymore. Used to. But yeah. Now, no. Alright. Yeah. No. Alright. So let me see here, man. I'm just double checking my email, make sure I didn't miss anything here. Okay, good. Alright. So listen, man, I got a bunch of stuff to talk to you about. More about the occupation, I think, here. Let me tell you again, Mitchell Plitnik. His debunking of the Iran, of the opposition to the Iran framework, by Mitchell Plitnik and Matt Dust. That can be found at fmep.org. Fmep.org. And it's really good. Kind of point by point thing debunking AIPAC. Make a copy, send it to your congressman staff. And then Elliot Abrams' shell game on the settlements can be found at Loeb Log, Jim Loeb, the great Jim Loeb, his blog, loeblog.com. Okay. And then, so here's an interview I got to do the research before I send the invite. The headline at antiwar.com by Jason Ditz, Israeli troops ordered to kill civilians on site during Gaza invasion. Soldiers confirm they deliberately targeted civilians. Israel has repeatedly denied reports of deliberate targeting of civilians during its wars in the Gaza Strip. Those claims were once again proven false today, that's yesterday, with the release of a new report by Israeli veterans, NGO, Breaking the Silence. The report features testimony from more than 60 Israeli soldiers who confirmed that not only did they deliberately target civilians during the most recent invasion, but they were explicitly ordered to do so. Whoever you see there, you kill, is how one soldier summed up the orders. He said soldiers were told the civilians knew they're not supposed to be there, and therefore they were to kill anyone who wasn't an Israeli soldier on site. Soldiers went on to say that traditional admonishments to use minimum force were thrown out the window in the war, and that civilian homes were deliberately attacked, quote, without any clear operational justification, sometimes just because the military wanted to demonstrate their military control over the neighborhoods. The report concluded that Israel's military had suffered from a broad ethical failure during the war, and one that extended from the top of the chain of command. During the month-long Israeli invasion, 2,189 Palestinians were killed. The overwhelming majority, 1,486, were civilians, including many ordered out of their neighborhoods and into UN facilities, which were then deliberately attacked. By facilities, schools, and refugee shelters. Though the IDF insists it is investigating claims of abuse, it has repeatedly denied any systematic wrongdoing during the war, saying it is the most ethical military ever. yeah, there you go, man. You know, you take that exact, I'm sorry I repeat myself all the time, but I'm so right about everything that I've already said everything perfectly before, so I can't help it. You take the exact myth of Israel, Poor little Israel. Tiny little strip of land next to the ocean, surrounded by big bad enemies, threatening all the time under siege to push them into the sea. And you take that exact line of crap about Israel, that's not hardly true by a million miles, and you apply that exact line directly to the Palestinians of the Gaza Strip, and it fits perfectly. They're the ones who are completely imprisoned. They're the ones who are surrounded by enemies with their back to the sea, who live in a concentration camp. That's all it is a big, it's like an Indian reservation, only they bomb it all the time. And you can't leave. And you can't fish. And you can't trade. And sometimes we'll blow up your children too, you know, with high explosives. We'll tear their bodies to shreds. And, there you go. Winter Soldier kind of thing over there in Israel right now. From the war a year ago. Almost a year ago now. Breaking the silence. They're at breakingthesilence.org.il. And they have this new report on Protective Edge. And I'm going to see what I can do to actually dig into the material. I have the tabs here, but I haven't gotten the work done. Man, I got so much work to do today. Anyway, I'll see what I can do to get the work done and to get somebody on the show to talk about this. But that's the reality of the Gaza Strip. And it's just unfair. As simple as that. There's nothing else to say. I mean, if you believe in the most basic American principles of the Declaration of Independence, that human beings are born with natural rights, then you have to be opposed to what goes on in Gaza. It's as simple as that. If Palestinians are human, then they own themselves, and then they own property that which they justly acquire, and they have the right to associate with whoever they want. To go wherever they want, to say whatever they want, to do whatever they want. Right? Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Sweet. Perfect timing. I had a complete and total catastrophe that entire commercial break long. And then, no problem. Let's see. Oh, 20 seconds of dead air. Oh, FTL, huh? Oh, it's still FTL. Uh-oh, that's a problem. Pipe me in, Ian. I'm back. Turn me on, man. Let me know, chat room guys, when you can hear me. Then I'll say something great. I don't know. Something. Damn, I had it fixed just in time. Am I back yet? Here's the show. I'm talking. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And you can follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show. If you want to do that, that should be cool. And, all right, I'm back, guys. Turn me on. Can you hear me? Hey, chat room guys, can you hear me? Am I live? What a crappy way to do a show. Now I can't seem to reach in, and I don't know what the hell. Well, for you people listening to the recording of this later, Israeli troops ordered to kill civilians on sight. Hey, I'm back. Oh, that's your voicemail. All right, well, anyway. Oh, what the hell? There you go. Can hear you? No. Huh? Now. Okay, good. Hey, here I am. All right, I'm Scott. It's my show. So, sorry about the technical jams. It was totally my fault. It wasn't FTL's fault. It was my internet kicked me off for no reason at all. Blame AT&T in the neighborhood. NSA patching in or whatever their damn problem is. And then what happened was all my computers got the internet back in about 5 seconds, but except for the one that talks to FTL, which decided to just sit there like a idiot So I just had to restart it. I didn't know what else to do. And that worked. So, god dang, stupid AT&T jerks. Blame them. All right. Anyway, so I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, yeah, man, so there's this new Winter Soldier-ish type thing breaking the silence here about the war in Gaza last time. Israeli commander, civilian toll will be even higher in the next Gaza war. Yeah. By the way, well, let me see here, man. I got so many. Oh, yeah, I definitely want to talk about that one and that one. Well, first of all, regarding the occupation, 7-year-old boy is arrested in East Jerusalem, interrogated for hours. So you think about how scary that would be if that was your local sheriff's department, arrested a 7-year-old boy, and no doubt treated him like a grown man. But then how about it's an occupying army of a foreign nation that are the ones that came and took him away. I guess we don't know if they tortured him or anything, you know. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But according to, I don't know how to say it right, Betzalem, is that how you say it? Maybe there's some silent letters in there. But there's a peace group in Israel. Their most prominent peace group in Israel. It's B apostrophe Salem or something like that, kind of a thing. Anyway, they've published about the torture of Palestinian children at length. By the IDF and the Shin Bet, which is like their domestic, you know, their FBI, their domestic Gestapo internal security force, which mostly applies to the Palestinian territories. And, of course, they've had pretty bad racial tensions over there, too. Dozens injured in Ethiopian-Israeli protest against police brutality in Tel Aviv, marching with Black Lives Matter signs and insisting on equal rights. And so they're black, but they're Jewish. So how much rights do they get? If Palestinian Arabs, Palestinian Arab Muslims and Christians are, I don't know, fourth class citizens, or I guess third class citizens, while those in the West Bank or in Gaza are 10th class citizens. So what does that make a Jewish black guy? Third, 3.25. Anyway, no equal rights for you, says Israeli policy there. And then massive clashes over that. And then I wonder about what American liberal Zionists think of this. Because, of course, you know, in their super majorities, American liberal Zionists are on the side of the poor blacks protesting all across the United States against police brutality right now here in America. So whose side are they on when it comes to the government of Israel? Seems like it'd be pretty hard to be a liberal Zionist in a time like this. You know, I don't know. What do I know? I know this. This is interesting. I don't know what it means, but I know that it's interesting to me. Israeli Foreign Minister Lieberman, who, of course, you might remember, recently called for the beheading of quote-unquote disloyal, which sounds like a thought crime more than an actual activity kind of a thing, you know? Disloyal Israeli, Palestinian Israelis, whatever you call them, Arab Israelis, Christians and Muslims, Israeli citizens who are not Jewish, that they should have their heads cut off, he said. But anyway, he won't be joining the new government. He insists ideological differences kept him out of the coalition, reports Jason Ditz at news.antiwar.com. Israeli Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman has announced today he and his party, Yisrael Betanu, will not be joining a new far-right coalition government. Okay, and so that party, they're basically... they're right-wing nationalists, but they're secularists, and they're mostly all Russians, I think. That's what, you know, that party is. They're right-wingers, but not religious right-wingers. And anyway, and he's, you know, said in the past, Hosni Mubarak, the most loyal American and Israeli sock puppet you could possibly imagine, one time wouldn't go to Tel Aviv to bend at the knee So let's just talk over the phone or something, guys. Jeez. And Avigdor Lieberman said, oh, yeah, well, if he doesn't like it, maybe we should just bomb the Aswan Dam. Whoa. Somebody give that guy a chill pill, man. Seems like a lot of collateral damage over a perceived slight, you know? Again, you know, that's just me. I'm just a guy over here, as Norm MacDonald would say. Anyway, Lieberman complained Netanyahu hadn't pledged massive expansions of settlements in the occupied territories and also hadn't committed to wiping out Hamas in a massive new war. So after his poor showing in this year's election, Lieberman no longer had the clout to make significant demands, and analysts are seeing this as his decline into effective irrelevance. Once seen as Netanyahu's heir apparent, corruption investigations of his party cut deeply into his already sagging support. Well, that much is good. Naftali Bennett is just as bad. All right, I guess we'll see what that means. But you celebrate as a small victory, right? All right, hang on.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
Hey guys, welcome back. I'm Scott. It's my show, Scott Horton Show. Huh. New Gareth? Hey, New Gareth. The media misses the point on proxy war. Ooh, about Syria. Gareth has not written much about Syria. I'll be very interested to read that. All right. So listen, I'm going to talk about Mike Huckabee for a second, but just for a second. Don't get me wrong. It's not a big presidential politics show. But I watched a little bit of his speech this morning when he announced he was running for president. And, what should I bother even mentioning about it? Well, first of all, he called the occupied territories Judea and Samaria, as though they were just part of Israel, not occupied territory where Palestinians live whatsoever. And then he pretended that Obama had ever done anything about what's going on in the West Bank whatsoever. And said, oh, boo-hoo, Obama, he's nicer. Ah, partisan politics. Give me a headache. He's nicer to the Ayatollahs in Iran for making nuclear bombs and some crap about Iran. Then Israel, just for housing policy in Judea and Samaria. Oh, man. And then, so here's the thing about this, and especially on the right, and especially on the left too, but especially on the right, with insincerity comes such conviction. And, which of course brings me to Rand Paul. All of these guys, and they got so many Republicans running, the way they're gonna frame it is, it's 8-1. Everybody knows we got to bomb Iran, and everybody knows this, that, and the other crap that all Republicans supposedly know. And the way all of their campaigns are going to frame it is, yeah, except for Rand, who's a liberal and a pansy, man, and nah, nah. And so he's got two options, and they're night and day, up and down, forward and backward, black and white sort of options here. He can either say, nuh-uh, I'm a stupid right-wing idiot who believes all these ridiculous, wrong, horrible things and wants to do all these ridiculous, wrong, horrible things to people, same as you guys, so please pick me because I'm just like all the rest of them. Or he can try for a minute to own it and just go ahead and say, yeah, you know what, my dad's right about that. Let's talk about Mark and Reprisal then, if you guys want to bring up Mark and Reprisal. Let's talk about Iran and their pathetic little electricity program that you cowards are all so terrified about. And let's talk about the consequences of your war in Libya and Syria that you helped cheer on when Hillary and Obama went and done did it. And et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's all he's got to do is go out there and kick their ass. You want to talk about poor people in the ghetto being oppressed? Why do you think they're so poor? Because you keep drumming up these gigantic bubbles with phony money to make your wars seem free. And then when the correction comes, it's like pulling the rug out from under the entire society. And then guess what? Racial minorities and the poor end up getting hit the hardest and have the hardest time getting back up again. But then they're getting back up and they're standing on another towel. And you guys are ready, or whatever it is, blanket or whatever. Pull the rug. That's the, why did I say towel? Pull the rug right out from under them. That's what they're standing on. A rug. He could just say that. And anyway, the point is, Ron, they go, oh yeah, Ron Paul is such a crazy old guy. Can Rand ever live him down? And the answer is no. But the rest of the answer is, Ron Paul is better on everything than Rand. And Ron Paul's positions on everything put the rest of the Republican candidates to shame. And so all Rand has to do is just stand there and be a younger Ron. That's all he's got to do, is just stand there and say, yeah, the truth is the truth. I'm not afraid to argue the truth. I'll whoop all of you guys. And what's he going to do in the debate? Run to the right on every question? Look at me, everyone. I'm indistinguishable from Mike Huckabee. Vote Paul. But why would they do that? And you know, Jim Antle is a conservative, kind of a paleocon. He's he writes for the Daily Caller. But he's kind of an anti-war guy. I think he reads antiwar.com and I think you know, he started getting this basically. He wrote a thing that was like a love letter to Rand, but it was really chock full of advice that basically in a much nicer way said the same thing that I'm saying now. He said, you know, an important model to possibly follow would be Justin Amash. Now, Justin Amash, if you look at him from a very simple, oversimplified, major media left-right point of view, boy, is he a right-winger on taxes. He's so far to the right on taxes. Oh, he's so far to the right on regulation. That's the way they look at it, because he's a libertarian. But then, so how does he make up for it when liberals and middle-of-the-road Republican, rhino-type Republicans try to smear him as some right-wing extremist? He outflanks them all on the left. On everything that the left is good on and should be good on, he's even better than them. So let's have real prison reform. Let's have real, I don't know all his issues, but they're good ones. Good civil liberties issues. Fourth Amendment stuff, Fifth Amendment stuff. And so then liberals go, no, we know this guy and we like him. And no, we don't disagree with him on, or we don't agree with him on everything. And maybe we don't even really like libertarians, but we like him. We believe what he says. He's standing on principle. And on a third of things, we agree with him. And they're very important things, like unlimited NSA spying for the rest of our lives or not. I mean, what are we doing here, man? And so that's how Justin Amash gets it done, is he's as libertarian as hell, basically. So instead of, and it's the difference between Ron Paul and Rand Paul, too. It's obvious. Ron Paul had something for everybody because he's a purist libertarian. Depending on your priorities, maybe you'll go with him or not, but he's not a right-wing extremist. You know, he's for sound money better than any other politician in the history of the world, is he, for sound money, right? But that didn't make him a right-wing extremist. He said he wanted to pardon every nonviolent drug offender. How right-wing is that? Boy, he's right-wing as hell on guns, but boy, he wants to bring the troops home. He joked. He didn't mean this literally, but he joked that we could defend this country with a couple of good submarines. We don't need all this militarism, all this world empire, all this collective security, so-called, at all. We could just come home from everywhere and then trade with everyone and have an open and free society and celebrate the very best parts of our heritage. Freedom, you know, that kind of thing. So he's completely anti-war, but he's not a right-wing old isolationist, right? And anyway, so I'm pointing out he's good on guns, he's good on criminal justice, all of these things. And you could call those left and right positions if you were a left or right-wing person. There you go. He's got enough by being as principled as hell. He's got enough to appeal to everybody. Rand should be moving that ball forward instead of pandering to everyone. Oh, what do I think the black community might want to hear, and what can I say to them? What do I think that the Fox News audience wants to hear, and what can I say to them? And what am I, what, you know, let me lick my finger and hold it up in the wind and figure out how I'll win for the short term. You know what? Here's a perfect example. Mayweather. This guy is killing boxing, but he doesn't care because he's looking at it only in the short term. I'm making, what was it, $100 million or whatever. So I don't care. If people decide that boxing is over and boring and it's all MMA from now on, what do I care, man? I just made $100 million for his own short-term gain at the expense of the larger interest. Or you look at it like a website that goes, you know, maybe pandering and ruining their brand by, trying to appeal to a wider audience, selling out what they were all about. It's the same kind of thing. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. That's funny. All right, yeah, so I'm Scott. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show.
Is this really a thing here, man? ISIS camps? People believe this, that the Islamic State has an outpost in Mexico? Give me a break.
Yeah, the things conservatives can be made to believe and be afraid of. There's really no end to it.
And yeah, liberals too, but different stuff.
Anyway, so yeah, later in the week we're going to have this guy, Abdi, Professor Abdi, what is it again? I have it here. Samatar. He's going to be on to talk about Somalia. That's good, man. We need somebody on to talk about Somalia again. And then we got this other guy coming on about the militarized high-tech police state, Michael Gould Wartofsky. That's a cool name, Wartofsky. He's going to be on to talk about the police state, too.
All right, so the Yemen war, man. Now, first thing about the Yemen war is why. So, as Coburn and others have talked about on the show, domestic politics, of course. This is how Saudis get ahead, by starting wars, just like Saudi politicians get ahead. Just like in every other society, they cause a conflict and then they pose as the solution to it. And so in this case, they're selling a big narrative that the Iranians are behind the Houthi, formerly the Houthi rebels, now the Houthi government, the Houthi takeover of Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, and that they're going to do something about it to save the Yemenis from the Iranian-backed takeover. Except, yeah, of course, it's all a bunch of lies. But it's good for Crown Prince, what's-his-name, to replace the other guy, which happened the other day. Help build him up and solidify the power of the new king, since the last one died. And then the other thing is, as our friend Mohammed Sahimi writes at the Huffington Post, it's to help to undermine the nuclear deal. To help undermine the narrative that we ought to be negotiating any kind of new terms with Iran at all. Now, yeah, Gareth on the show, I did. You heard him on the show yesterday.
explaining how there's going to be no rapprochement with Iran. Maybe we'll get the Iran nuclear deal through, but it's not going to be going to Tehran kind of a thing here, man, where we just end up switching sides over to the Shiite side and away from the Saudis. I mean, that's just, that's too many interests going the other way, I think. And try to warm up to both and do dual containment of both and dual building up of both. Sorry for hiccuping in your ear. That was probably gross. But, see, it doesn't really matter what the truth is. It just matters what the Saudis believe. In this case, apparently, they're pretty damn paranoid that the Americans have decided to throw them overboard and go ahead back to the bad old days of the 1970s where we were closer to Iran, or at least used Iran to contain them and balance them in a way that they're not used to it being that way lately. Or at least, actually, that's not true. We have been using Iran to limit their power in Iraq, but that was mostly a big oops. Shouldn't have listened to the neocons who were listening to Ahmed Chalabi, who was working for Iran, you stupid idiots. So that was more like picking the Shiite Iran side in the civil war against the Sunni Saudi side accidentally. But we've had a redirection since then, and I don't think we're really redirecting back. As Gareth put it, that might make sense for strategy in the region as far as that goes. You know, on the face of it anyway. But it's not going to happen because there's too many other reasons why not. Too many other interests involved. And so, but there's the Sunni kings of the Gulf, and particularly the Saudis, they're paranoid that the Americans are throwing them overboard. And so attacking Yemen and needing our assistance and doing so all in the name of limiting the expanding Iranian empire in the region becomes a great way to help sabotage any form of any real normalization of relations between America and Iran. That's got to be at least a major part of it. And that's what Sahimi writes in this article at Huffington Post. Saudi attack on Yemen aims to prevent thaw between Iran and the West. And, yeah, isn't it too bad that the American people didn't just elect Ron Paul back in 2008? Well, for that matter, 88. Whew, man, can you imagine? End of NATO and the entire Cold War in every way and all that. Boy, would that have been different, better. But anyway, 20 years later when he ran in 2008, that sure would have been nice. Because his attitude would have been, all sanctions lifted, let's be friends. You don't even have to agree. We just want to be friends with you. That's our official position. No alliances with any Middle East powers. But no enemies either. Let's all trade. You know what? Dick Cheney was right way back in 1996 when he was for normalizing relations with Iran. Ah, come on, where's my clip? Oh, here it is, 98. I got the clip, everybody. Oh, yeah, this thing always takes a second to play. Play, damn you. Oh, come on.
We find ourselves these days, American firms, cut out of the action in terms of anything that develops with respect to Iran. Unfortunately, as has been pointed out repeatedly in recent weeks, our government has become sanctions happy.
Yeah. Our government has become sanctions happy. They're preventing us from doing business with Iran, Dick Cheney complained back in 1998. Overseas on foreign soil, he dared to say that. High treason, I tells ya. I mean, roughly paraphrasing every single Dick Cheney supporter from the last administration. But anyway, Ron Paul would have said, yeah, that's right. All sanctions lifted. All alliances over. Friendship all around. Entangling alliances with none. And then, boy, things would be better and different. You know, it's my same sort of theory about, you know, really the same situation, only in a smaller, through a smaller lens in the Iraq War. Even if America, which of course I oppose the whole thing all along and everything, but even if America had overthrown Saddam and just left, or maybe if they had supported the Shiite and Kurdish revolution against Saddam in 1991 and just left, that at least the incentive would have been much stronger there for the majority Shiites to work something out with the minority Sunni in a nationalist kind of a way, without the massive million-man dead civil war that the Americans staged instead by invading, toppling Saddam, and staying and picking the side of the majority and fighting as their auxiliaries to cleanse especially the capital, but to fight against the remnants of the Sunni Ba'athist power and the local Sunni nationalists and whatever other resistance too. It was a much worse situation than if they had just, you know, stayed back. And, you know, Barry Lando said on this show, a journalist who covered the first Gulf War in depth and wrote a book about it and all that, he explained that not only did they encourage the Shiite uprising and then stab him in the back and not do anything to help him, in fact, even let Saddam keep his attack helicopters to use to massacre him. But Lando said, isn't that a cool name? The guy's name is Lando, really. He said that the Americans landed helicopters of their own on the highway to Baghdad in order to block an Iraqi army, not a bunch of Shiite militias, an Iraqi army division that was marching on Baghdad, marching on Saddam, to depose him, and the Americans stopped them. So, anyway, all we do is just distort power over there a million ways. And, you know, I don't know. It's just like I tried to warn you, 12 years ago now. Boy, the consequences of all this are going to last for decades now. You know, this is the first time that the Shiites have controlled an Arab capital city in 1,000 years. There was once a Shiite dynasty in Egypt, but that was 1,000 years ago. And so I'm not saying that's a horrible thing just in and of itself, but in terms of the consequences of how Bush distorted power on the ground there, and the forces that he lined up to go to war with each other, you know, from here on out, pretty damn severe. Oh, and then Obama doubled down by backing the Mujahideen, the Sunni side of the war in Libya and Syria, too. Don't ever let me neglect to mention that. Boy, nice talking. Anyway, thanks for listening to me, guys. See you tomorrow.